together to help individuals meet the adaptive challenge of forging beneficial relationships within hierarchies. We are the descendants of the individuals who are best able to play the game, to rise in status while cultivating the protection of superiors and the allegiance of subordinates. The original triggers of some of these modules include patterns of appearance and behavior that indicate higher versus lower rank. Like chimpanzees, people track and remember who is above whom. When people within a hierarchical order act in ways that negate or subvert that order, we feel it instantly, even if we ourselves have not been directly harmed. If authority is in part about protecting order and fending off chaos, then everyone has a stake in supporting the existing order and in holding people accountable for fulfilling the obligations of their station. The current triggers of the Authority Subversion Foundation, therefore, include anything that is construed as an act of obedience, disobedience, respect, disrespect, submission, or rebellion with regard to authorities perceived to be legitimate. Current triggers also include acts that are seen to subvert the traditions, institutions, or values that are perceived to provide stability. As with the Loyalty Foundation, it is much easier for the political right to build on this foundation than it is for the left, which often defines itself in part by its opposition to hierarchy, inequality, and power. It should not be difficult for you to guess the politics of the magazine advertised in Figure 7.7. The top image in Figure 7.7 shows an advertisement for the liberal magazine The Nation. It says, "What's your nation?" and then shows a coffee mug with the word "insubordination" written across it. Conversely, while Methodists are not necessarily conservative, the sign in front of their church tells you they ain't no Unitarians. The bottom image in Figure 7.7 shows the sign in front of a church in Charlottesville, Virginia. The sermon advertised for the upcoming Sunday is titled, "God's in Charge, So Shut Up." 5. The Sanctity Degradation Foundation. In early 2001, Armin Muse, a German computer technician, posted an unusual advertisement on the web, quote, "Looking for a well-built 21 to 30-year-old to be slaughtered and then consumed," end quote. Hundreds of men responded by email, and Muse interviewed a few of them at his farmhouse. Bernd Brand, a 43-year-old computer engineer, was the first respondent who didn't change his mind when he realized that Muse was not engaging in mere fantasy. Warning: squeamish listeners should fast forward through the next 30 seconds. On the evening of March 9th, the two men made a video to prove that Brand fully consented to what was about to happen. Brand then took some sleeping pills and alcohol, but he was still alert when Muse cut off Brand's penis after being unable to bite it off as Brand had requested. Muse then sautéed the penis in a frying pan with wine and garlic. Brand took a bite of it, then went off to a bathtub to bleed to death. A few hours later, Brand was not yet dead, so Muse kissed him, stabbed him in the throat, and then hung the body on a meat hook to strip off the flesh. Muse stored the flesh in his freezer and ate it gradually over the next 10 months. Muse was ultimately caught, arrested, and tried, but because Brand's participation was fully voluntary, Muse was convicted only of manslaughter, not murder, the first time the case went to trial. If your moral matrix is limited to the ethic of autonomy, you're at high risk of being dumbfounded by this case. You surely find it disturbing, and the violence of it probably activates your Care Harm Foundation. But any attempt to condemn Muse or Brand runs smack into John Stuart Mill's harm principle, which I introduced in Chapter 5. Quote, "The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others," end quote. The next line of the original quote is, quote, "His own good, either physical or moral, is not sufficient warrant," end quote. From within the ethic of autonomy, people have a right to live their lives as they please, as long as they harm nobody, and they have a right to end their lives how and when they please, as long as they leave no dependents unsupported. Brand chose an extraordinarily revolting means of death. But as the Penn students in my dissertation research often said, just because something is disgusting, that doesn't make it wrong. Yet most people feel that there was something terribly wrong here, and that it should be against the law for adults to engage in consensual activities such as this. why. Imagine that Muse had served his prison sentence and then returned to his home. Assume that a team of psychiatrists established that he posed no threat to anyone who did not explicitly ask to be eaten. Imagine that his home was one block away from your home. Would you find his return unsettling? If Muse was then forced by social pressure to move out of your town, might you feel some relief? And what about the house where this atrocity happened? How much would someone have to pay you to live in it for a week? Might you feel that the stain would be expunged only if the house was burned to the ground? These feelings of stain, pollution, and purification are irrational from a utilitarian point of view, but they make perfect sense in Schwader's ethic of divinity. Muse and Brand colluded to treat Brand's body as a piece of meat, to which they added the extra horror of a splash of sexuality. They behaved monstrously, as low as any humans can go on the vertical dimension of divinity that I discussed in Chapter 5. Only worms and demons eat human flesh. But why do we care so much what other people choose to do with their bodies? Most animals are born knowing what to eat. A koala bear's sensory systems are structured in advance of experience to guide it to eucalyptus leaves. Humans, however, must learn what to eat. Like rats and cockroaches, we're omnivores. Being an omnivore has the enormous advantage of flexibility. You can wander into a new continent and be quite confident that you'll find something to eat. But it also has the disadvantage that new foods can be toxic, infected with microbes, or riddled with parasitic worms. The omnivore's dilemma, a term coined by Paul Rozin, is that omnivores must seek out and explore new potential foods while remaining wary of them until they are proven safe. Omnivores therefore go through life with two competing motives, neophilia, an attraction to new things, and neophobia, a fear of new things. People vary in terms of which motive is stronger, and this variation will come back to help us in later chapters. Liberals score higher on measures of neophilia, also known as openness to experience, not just for new foods, but also for new people, music, and ideas. Conservatives are higher on neophobia. They prefer to stick with what's tried and true, and they care a lot more about guarding borders, boundaries, and traditions. The emotion of disgust evolved initially to optimize responses to the omnivore's dilemma. Individuals who had a properly calibrated sense of disgust were able to consume more calories than their overly disgustable cousins, while consuming fewer dangerous microbes than their insufficiently disgustable cousins. But it's not just food that posed a threat. When early hominids came down from the trees and began living in larger groups on the ground, they greatly increased their risk of infection from each other and from each other's waste products. The psychologist Mark Schaller has shown that disgust is part of what he calls the behavioral immune system, a set of cognitive modules that are triggered by signs of infection or disease in other people and that make you want to get away from those people. It's a lot more effective to prevent infection by washing your food, casting out lepers, or simply avoiding dirty people, than it is to let the microbes into your body and then hope that your biological immune system can kill every last one of them. The original adaptive challenge that drove the evolution of the Sanctity Foundation, therefore, was the need to avoid pathogens, parasites, and other threats that spread by physical touch or proximity. The original triggers of the key modules that comprise this foundation include smells, sights, or other sensory patterns that predict the presence of dangerous pathogens in people or objects. Examples include human corpses, excrement, scavengers such as vultures, and people with visible lesions or sores. The current triggers of the Sanctity Foundation, however, are extraordinarily variable and expandable across cultures and eras. A common and direct expansion is to outgroup members. Cultures differ in their attitudes towards immigrants, and there is some evidence that liberal and welcoming attitudes are more common in times and places where disease risks are lower. Plagues, epidemics, and new diseases are usually brought in by foreigners, as are many new ideas, goods, and technologies. So societies face an analog of the omnivore's dilemma, balancing xenophobia and xenophilia. As with the Authority Foundation, sanctity seems to be off to a poor start as a foundation of morality. Isn't it just a primitive response to pathogens? And doesn't this response lead to prejudice and discrimination? now that we have antibiotics, we should reject this foundation entirely, right? Not so fast. The Sanctity Foundation makes it easy for us to regard some things as untouchable, both in a bad way, because something is so dirty or polluted we want to stay away, and in a good way, because something is so hallowed, so sacred, that we want to protect it from desecration. If we had no sense of disgust, I believe we would also have no sense of the sacred. And if you think, as I do, that one of the greatest unsolved mysteries is how people ever came together to form large cooperative societies, then you might take a special interest in the psychology of sacredness. Why do people so readily treat objects, such as flags and crosses, places, such as Mecca or a battlefield related to the birth of your nation, people, such as saints and heroes, and principles, such as liberty, fraternity, and equality, as though they were of infinite value? Whatever its origins, the psychology of sacredness helps bind individuals into moral communities. When someone in a moral community desecrates one of the sacred pillars supporting the community, the reaction is sure to be swift, emotional, collective, and punitive. To return, finally, to Muse and Brand, they caused no harm to anyone in a direct, material, or utilitarian way. But they desecrated several of the bedrock moral principles of Western society, such as our shared belief that human life is supremely valuable and that the human body is more than just a walking slab of meat. They trampled on these principles not out of necessity and not in service to a higher goal, but out of carnal desire. If Mill's harm principle prevents us from outlawing their actions, then Mill's harm principle seems inadequate as the basis for a moral community. Whether or not God exists, people feel that some things, actions, and people are noble, pure, and elevated. Others are base, polluted, and degraded. Does the Muse case tell us anything about politics? It's too revolting a case to use in research. I'm confident that liberals and conservatives would all condemn Muse, although I'm not so sure about libertarians. But if we turn down the disgust a few notches, we see a vast difference between left and right over the use of concepts such as sanctity and purity. American conservatives are more likely to talk about the sanctity of life and the sanctity of marriage. Conservatives, particularly religious conservatives, are more likely to view the body as a temple housing a soul within, rather than as a machine to be optimized or as a playground to be used for fun. The two images in Figure 7.8 show exactly the contrast that Schwader had described in his Ethic of Divinity. The image on top is from a 15th century painting, The Allegory of Chastity. It shows the Virgin Mary raised and protected by an amethyst rock formation. From beneath her flows a stream, symbolizing her purity, guarded by two lions. The painting portrays chastity as a virtue, a treasure to be guarded. This idea is not just ancient history. It inspired a virginity pledge movement in the United States as recently as the 1990s. The group Silver Ring Thing asks its members to vow to remain celibate and pure until marriage. Those who make the vow are given a silver ring to wear like a wedding ring, inscribed with the name of Bible verses, such as 1 Thessalonians 4, 3-4. Those verses state, quote, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from fornication, that each one of you know how to control your own body in holiness and honor." End quote. On the left, however, the virtue of chastity is usually dismissed as outdated and sexist. Jeremy Bentham urged us to maximize our hedons, or pleasures, and minimize our dolors, or pains. If your morality focuses on individuals and their conscious experiences, then why on earth should anyone not use their body as a playground? Devout Christians are often lampooned by secular liberals as uptight, pleasure-fearing prudes. The Sanctity Foundation is used most heavily by the religious right, but it is also used on the spiritual left. You can see the Foundation's original impurity avoidance function in New Age grocery stores, where you'll find a variety of products that promise to cleanse you of toxins. And you'll find the Sanctity Foundation underlying some of the moral passions of the environmental movement. Many environmentalists revile industrialism, capitalism, and automobiles, not just for the physical pollution they create, but also for a more symbolic kind of pollution, a degradation of nature and of humanity's original nature before it was corrupted by industrial capitalism. The Sanctity Foundation is crucial for understanding the American culture wars, particularly over biomedical issues. If you dismiss the Sanctity Foundation entirely, then it's hard to understand the fuss over most of today's biomedical controversies. The only question about abortion becomes, at what point can a fetus feel pain? Doctor-assisted suicide becomes an obviously good thing. People who are suffering should be allowed to end their lives and should be given medical help to do it painlessly. Same for stem cell research. Why not take tissue from all those embryos living in suspended animation in fertility clinics? They can't feel pain, but their tissues could help researchers develop cures that would spare sentient people from pain. The philosopher Leon Cass is among the foremost spokesmen for Schwader's ethic of divinity and for the Sanctity Foundation on which it is based. Writing in 1997, the year after Dolly the sheep became the first cloned mammal, Cass lamented the way that technology often erases moral boundaries and brings people ever closer to the dangerous belief that they can do anything they want to do. In an essay titled The Wisdom of Repugnance, Cass argued that our feelings of disgust can sometimes provide us with a valuable warning that we are going too far, even when we are morally dumbfounded and can't justify those feelings by pointing to victims. Quote, "Repugnance, here as elsewhere, revolts against the excesses of human willfulness, warning us not to transgress what is unspeakably profound. Indeed, in this age in which everything is held to be permissible so long as it is freely done, in which our given human nature no longer commands respect, in which our bodies are regarded as mere instruments of our autonomous rational wills, repugnance may be the only voice left that speaks up to defend the central core of our humanity. Shallow are the souls that have forgotten how to shudder." End quote. In sum, I began this chapter by trying to trigger your intuitions about the five moral foundations that I introduced in Chapter 6. I then defined innateness as organized in advance of experience, like the first draft of a book that gets revised as individuals grow up within diverse cultures. This definition allowed me to propose that the moral foundations are innate. Particular rules and virtues vary across cultures, so you'll get fooled if you look for universality in the finished books. You won't find a single paragraph that exists in identical form in every human culture. But if you look for links between evolutionary theory and anthropological observations, you can take some educated guesses about what was in the universal first draft of human nature. I tried to make and justify five such guesses. 1. The Care-Harm Foundation evolved in response to the adaptive challenge of caring for vulnerable children. It makes us sensitive to signs of suffering and need. It makes us despise cruelty and want to care for those who are suffering. 2. The Fairness Cheating Foundation evolved in response to the adaptive challenge of reaping the rewards of cooperation without getting exploited. It makes us sensitive to indications that another person is likely to be a good or bad partner for collaboration and reciprocal altruism. It makes us want to shun or punish cheaters. 3. The Loyalty Betrayal Foundation evolved in response to the adaptive challenge of forming and maintaining coalitions. It makes us sensitive to signs that another person is or is not a team player. It makes us trust and reward such people, and it makes us want to hurt, ostracize, or even kill those who betray us or our group. 4. The Authority Subversion Foundation evolved in response to the adaptive challenge of forging relationships that will benefit us within social hierarchies. It makes us sensitive to signs of rank and status, and to signs that other people are or are not behaving properly given their position. 5. The Sanctity Degradation Foundation evolved initially in response to the adaptive challenge of the omnivore's dilemma, and then to the broader challenge of living in a world of pathogens and parasites. It includes the behavioral immune system, which can make us wary of a diverse array of symbolic objects and threats. It makes it possible for people to invest objects with irrational and extreme values, both positive and negative, which are important for binding groups together. I showed how the two ends of the political spectrum rely upon each foundation in different ways or to different degrees. It appears that the left relies primarily on the Care and Fairness Foundations, whereas the right uses all five. If this is true, Then is the morality of the left like the food served in the True Taste restaurant? Does left-wing morality activate just one or two taste receptors, whereas right-wing morality engages a broader palate, including loyalty, authority, and sanctity? And if so, does that give conservative politicians a broader variety of ways to connect with voters? Chapter 8, The Conservative Advantage. In January 2005, I was invited to speak to the Charlottesville Democratic Party about moral psychology. I welcomed the chance because I had spent much of 2004 as a speechwriter for John Kerry's presidential campaign. Not a paid speechwriter, just a guy who, while walking his dog every evening, mentally rewrote some of Kerry's ineffectual appeals. For example, in Kerry's acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention, he listed a variety of failures of the Bush administration, and after each one, he proclaimed, "America can do better," and "Help is on the way." The first slogan connected to no moral foundation at all. The second one connected weakly to the Care Harm Foundation, but only if you think of America as a nation of helpless citizens who need a Democratic president to care for them. In my rewrite, Kerry listed a variety of Bush's campaign promises, and after each one, he asked, "You gonna pay for that, George?" That simple slogan would have made Bush's many new programs, coming on top of his tax cuts and vast expenditures on two wars, look like shoplifting rather than generosity. Kerry could have activated the cheater detection modules of the Fairness Cheating Foundation. The message of my talk to the Charlottesville Democrats was simple. Republicans understand moral psychology, Democrats don't. Republicans have long understood that the elephant is in charge of political behavior, not the rider. And they know how elephants work. Their slogans, political commercials, and speeches go straight for the gut, as in the infamous 1988 ad showing a mugshot of a black man, Willie Horton, who committed a brutal murder after being released from prison on a weekend furlough by the soft-on-crime Democratic candidate, Governor Michael Dukakis. Democrats have often aimed their appeals more squarely at the rider, emphasizing specific policies and the benefits they'll bring to you, the voter. Neither George W. Bush nor his father, George H.W. Bush, had the ability to move audiences to tears, but both had the great fortune to run against cerebral and emotionally cool Democrats, Michael Dukakis, Al Gore, and John Kerry. It is no coincidence that the only Democrat since Franklin Roosevelt to win election and then re-election combined gregariousness and oratorical skill with an almost musical emotionality. Bill Clinton knew how to charm elephants. Republicans don't just aim to cause fear, as some Democrats charge. They trigger the full range of intuitions described by moral foundations theory. Like Democrats, they can talk about innocent victims of harmful Democratic policies and about fairness, particularly the unfairness of taking tax money from hardworking and prudent people to support cheaters, slackers, and irresponsible fools. But Republicans since Nixon have had a near monopoly on appeals to loyalty, particularly patriotism and military virtues, and authority, including respect for parents, teachers, elders, and the police, as well as for traditions. And after they embraced Christian conservatives during Ronald Reagan's 1980 campaign and became the party of family values, Republicans inherited a powerful network of Christian ideas about sanctity and sexuality that allowed them to portray the Democrats as the party of Sodom and Gomorrah. Set against the rising crime and chaos of the 1960s and 1970s, this five-foundation morality had wide appeal even to many Democrats, the so-called Reagan Democrats. The moral vision offered by the Democrats since the 1960s, in contrast, seemed narrow, too focused on helping victims and fighting for the rights of the oppressed. The Democrats offered just sugar, care, and salt, fairness as a quality, whereas Republican morality appealed to all five taste receptors. That was the story I told to the Charlottesville Democrats. I didn't blame the Republicans for trickery. I blamed the Democrats for psychological naivete. I expected an angry reaction, but after two consecutive losses to George W. Bush, Democrats were so hungry for an explanation that the audience seemed willing to consider mine. Back then, however, my explanation was just speculation. I had not yet collected any data to support my claim that conservatives responded to a broader set of moral tastes than did liberals. Measuring morals. Fortunately, a graduate student arrived at UVA that year who made an honest man out of me. If Match.com had offered a way to pair up advisors and grad students, I couldn't have found a better partner than Jesse Graham. He had graduated from the University of Chicago, scholarly breadth, earned a master's degree at Harvard Divinity School, an appreciation of religion, and then spent a year teaching English in Japan, cross-cultural experience. For Jesse's first-year research project, he created a questionnaire to measure people's scores on the five moral foundations. We worked with my colleague, Brian Nosek, to create the first version of the Moral Foundations Questionnaire, MFQ, which began with these instructions. Quote, when you decide whether something is right or wrong, to what extent are the following considerations relevant to your thinking? End quote. We then explained the response scale from 0, not at all relevant, this has nothing to do with my judgments of right and wrong, to 5, extremely relevant, this is one of the most important factors when I judge right and wrong. We then listed 15 statements, 3 for each of the 5 foundations, such as whether or not someone was cruel, for the CARE Foundation, or whether or not someone showed a lack of respect for authority, for the Authority Foundation. Brian was the director of ProjectImplicit.org, one of the largest research sites on the internet, so we were able to recruit 1,600 subjects to fill out the MFQ within a week. When Jesse graphed the data, he found exactly the differences we had predicted. I've reprinted Jesse's graph in Figure 8.1, which shows responses from people who said that they were very liberal on the far left, and then moves along the political spectrum through moderates in the middle to people who self-identified as very conservative, shown on the far right. As you can see, the lines for care and fairness, the two top lines, are moderately high across the board. Everyone, left, right, and center, says that concerns about compassion, cruelty, fairness, and injustice are relevant to their judgments about right and wrong. Yet still, the lines slope downward. Liberals say that these issues are a bit more relevant to morality than do conservatives. But when we look at the Loyalty, Authority, and Sanctity Foundations, the story is quite different. Liberals largely reject these considerations. They show such a large gap between these foundations versus the CARE and Fairness Foundations that we might say, as a shorthand, that liberals have a two-foundation morality. As we move to the right, however, the lines slope upward. By the time we reach people who are very conservative, all 5 lines have converged. We can say, as a shorthand, that conservatives have a 5-foundation morality. But can it really be true that conservatives care about a broader range of moral values and issues than do liberals? Or did this pattern only arise because of the particular questions that we happened to ask? Over the next year, Jesse, Brian, and I refined the MFQ. We added questions that asked people to rate their agreement with statements we wrote to trigger intuitions related to each foundation. For example, do you agree with this care item? One of the worst things a person can do is to hurt a defenseless animal. How about this loyalty item? It is more important to be a team player than to express oneself. Jesse's original findings replicated beautifully. We found the same pattern as in Figure 8.1, and we found it in subjects from many countries besides the United States. I began to show our graphs whenever I gave lectures about moral psychology. Ravi Iyer, a graduate student at the University of Southern California, heard me speak in the fall of 2006 and emailed me to ask if he could use the MFQ in his research on attitudes about immigration. Ravi was a skilled web programmer, and he offered to help Jesse and me create a website for our own research. At around the same time, Sena Koleva, a graduate student at the University of California at Irvine, asked me if she could use the MFQ. Sena was studying political psychology with her advisor, Pete Ditto, whose work on motivated reasoning I described in Chapter 4. I said yes to both requests. Every January, social psychologists from all over the world flock to a single conference to learn about each other's work and to gossip, network, and drink. In 2007, that conference was held in Memphis, Tennessee. Ravi, Sena, Pete, Jesse, and I met late one evening at the hotel bar to share our findings and get to know one another. All 5 of us were politically liberal, yet we shared the same concern about the way our liberal field approached political psychology. The goal of so much research was to explain what was wrong with conservatives. Why don't conservatives embrace equality, diversity, and change like normal people? Just that day, in a session on political psychology, several of the speakers had made jokes about conservatives or about the cognitive limitations of President Bush. All five of us felt this was wrong, not just morally, because it creates a hostile climate for the few conservatives who might have been in the audience, but also scientifically, because it reveals a motivation to reach certain conclusions, and we all knew how easy it is for people to reach their desired conclusions. The five of us also shared a deep concern about the polarization and incivility of American political life, and we wanted to use moral psychology to help political partisans understand and respect each other. We talked about several ideas for future studies, and for each one, Ravi said, "You know, we could do that online." He proposed that we create a website where people could register when they first visit and then take part in dozens of studies on moral and political psychology. We could then link all of their responses together and develop a comprehensive moral profile for each anonymous visitor. In return, we'd give visitors detailed feedback showing them how they compared to others. If we made the feedback interesting enough, people would tell their friends about the site. Over the next few months, Ravi designed the website, www.yourmorals.org, and the five of us worked together to improve it. On May 9th, we got approval from the UVA Human Subjects Committee to conduct the research, and the site went live the next day. Within a few weeks, we were getting 10 or more visitors a day. Then, in August, the science writer Nicholas Wade interviewed me for an article in the New York Times on the roots of morality. He included the name of our website. The article ran on September 18th, and by the end of that week, 26,000 new visitors had completed one or more of our surveys. Figure 8.2 shows our data on the MFQ as it stood in 2011, with more than 130,000 subjects. We've made many improvements since Jesse's first simple survey, but we always find the same basic pattern that he found in 2006. The lines for care and fairness slant downward. The lines for loyalty, authority, and sanctity slant upward. Liberals value care and fairness far more than the other three foundations. Conservatives endorse all five foundations more or less equally. We found this basic difference no matter how we ask the questions. For example, in one study, we asked people which traits would make them more or less likely to choose a particular breed of dog as a pet. On which side of the political spectrum do you suppose these traits would be most appealing? The breed is extremely gentle. The breed is very independent-minded and relates to its owner as a friend and equal. The breed is extremely loyal to its home and family, and it doesn't warm up quickly to strangers. The breed is very obedient and is easily trained to take orders. The breed is very clean and, like a cat, takes great care with its personal hygiene. We found that people want dogs that fit their own moral matrices. Liberals want dogs that are gentle, i.e., that fit with the values of the Care Foundation, and relate to their owners as equals, fairness as equality. Conservatives, on the other hand, want dogs that are loyal, loyalty, and obedient, authority. The sanctity item showed no partisan tilt. Both sides prefer clean dogs. The converging pattern shown in Figure 8.2 is not just something we find in internet surveys. We find it in church, too. Jesse obtained the text of dozens of sermons that were delivered in Unitarian churches, which are liberal, and dozens more that were delivered in Southern Baptist churches, which are conservative. Before reading the sermons, Jesse identified hundreds of words that were conceptually related to each foundation. For example, peace, care, and compassion on the positive side of care, and suffer, cruel, and brutal on the negative side. Obey, duty, and honor on the positive side of authority, and defy, disrespect, and rebel on the negative side. Jesse then used a computer program called LUC, Linguistic Inquiry Word Count, to count the number of times that each word was used in the two sets of texts. This simple-minded method confirmed our findings from the MFQ. Unitarian preachers made greater use of care and fairness words, while Baptist preachers made greater use of loyalty, authority, and sanctity words. We find this pattern in brain waves, too. We teamed up with Jamie Morris, a social neuroscientist at UVA, to present liberal and conservative students with 60 sentences that came in two versions. One version endorsed an idea consistent with a particular foundation, and the other version rejected the idea. For example, half of our subjects read, "Total equality in the workplace is necessary," The other half read, "Total equality in the workplace is unrealistic." Subjects wore a special cap to measure their brainwaves as the words in each sentence were flashed up on a screen, one word at a time. We later looked at the encephalogram, the EEG, to determine whose brains showed evidence of surprise or shock at the moment that the keyword was presented, e.g., necessary versus unrealistic. Liberal brains showed more surprise compared to conservative brains in response to sentences that rejected care and fairness concerns. They also showed more surprise in response to sentences that endorsed loyalty, authority, and sanctity concerns. For example, in the teenage years, parental advice should be heeded versus should be questioned. In other words, when people choose the labels liberal or conservative, they are not just choosing to endorse different values on questionnaires. Within the first half second after hearing a statement, partisan brains are already reacting differently. These initial flashes of neural activity are the elephant leaning slightly, which then causes their riders to reason differently, search for different kinds of evidence, and reach different conclusions. Intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. What makes people vote Republican? When Barack Obama clinched the Democratic nomination for the presidential race, I was thrilled. At long last, it seemed, the Democrats had chosen a candidate with a broader moral palette, someone able to speak about all five foundations. In his book, The Audacity of Hope, Obama showed himself to be a liberal who understood conservative arguments about the need for order and the value of tradition. When he gave a speech on Father's Day at a black church, he praised marriage and the traditional two-parent family, and he called on black men to take more responsibility for their children. When he gave a speech on patriotism, he criticized the liberal counterculture of the 1960s for burning American flags and for failing to honor veterans returning from Vietnam. But as the summer of 2008 went on, I began to worry. His speech to a major civil rights organization was all about social justice and corporate greed. It used only the care and fairness foundations, and fairness often meant equality of outcomes. In his famous speech in Berlin, he introduced himself as a fellow citizen of the world, and he spoke of global citizenship. He had created a controversy earlier in the summer by refusing to wear an American flag pin on the lapel of his jacket, as American politicians typically do. The controversy seemed absurd to liberals, but the Berlin speech reinforced the emerging conservative narrative that Obama was a liberal universalist, someone who could not be trusted to put the interests of his nation above the interests of the rest of the world. His opponent, John McCain, took advantage of Obama's failure to build on the Loyalty Foundation with his own campaign motto, Country First. Anxious that Obama would go the way of Gore and Kerry, I wrote an essay applying moral foundations theory to the presidential race. I wanted to show Democrats how they could talk about policy issues in ways that would activate more than two foundations. John Brockman, who runs an online scientific salon at edge.org, invited me to publish the essay at Edge, as long as I stripped out most of the advice and focused on the moral psychology. I titled the essay, What Makes People Vote Republican? I began by summarizing the standard explanations that psychologists had offered for decades. Conservatives are conservative because they were raised by overly strict parents, or because they are inordinately afraid of change, novelty, and complexity, or because they suffer from existential fears and therefore cling to a simple worldview with no shades of gray. These approaches all had one feature in common. They used psychology to explain away conservatism. They made it unnecessary for liberals to take conservative ideas seriously because these ideas are caused by bad childhoods or ugly personality traits. I suggested a very different approach. Start by assuming that conservatives are just as sincere as liberals, and then use moral foundations theory to understand the moral matrices of both sides. The key idea in the essay was that there are two radically different approaches to the challenge of creating a society in which unrelated people can live together peacefully. One approach was exemplified by John Stuart Mill, the other by the great French sociologist Émile Durkheim. I described Mill's vision like this. Quote, "First, imagine society as a social contract invented for our mutual benefit. All individuals are equal, and all should be left as free as possible to move, develop talents, and form relationships as they please. The patron saint of a contractual society is John Stuart Mill, who wrote, in On Liberty, that the only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. Mill's vision appeals to many liberals and libertarians. A million society, at its best, would be a peaceful, open, and creative place where diverse individuals respect each other's rights and band together voluntarily, as in Obama's calls for unity, to help those in need or to change the laws for the common good. End quote. I showed how this vision of society rests exclusively on the Care and Fairness Foundations. If you assume that everyone relies on those two foundations, you can assume that people will be bothered by cruelty and injustice and will be motivated to respect each other's rights. I then contrasted Mill's vision with Durkheim's. Quote, "Now imagine society not as an agreement among individuals, but as something that emerged organically over time as people found ways of living together, binding themselves to each other, suppressing each other's selfishness, and punishing the deviants and free riders who eternally threaten to undermine cooperative groups. The basic social unit is not the individual, it is the hierarchically structured family, which serves as a model for other institutions. Individuals in such societies are born into strong and constraining relationships that profoundly limit their autonomy. The patron saint of this more binding moral system is the sociologist Emil Durkheim, who warned of the dangers of anomy, or normlessness, and wrote in 1897 that man cannot become attached to higher aims and submit to a rule if he sees nothing above him to which he belongs. To free himself from all social pressure is to abandon himself and demoralize him. A Durkheimian society, at its best, would be a stable network composed of many nested and overlapping groups that socialize, reshape, and care for individuals who, if left to their own devices, would pursue shallow, carnal, and selfish pleasures. A Durkheimian society would value self-control over self-expression, duty over rights, and loyalty to one's group over concerns for outgroups. End quote. I showed that a Durkheimian society cannot be supported by the Care and Fairness Foundations alone. You have to build on the Loyalty, Authority, and Sanctity Foundations as well. I then showed how the American left fails to understand social conservatives and the religious right because it cannot see a Durkheimian world as anything other than a moral abomination. A Durkheimian world is usually hierarchical, punitive, and religious. It places limits on people's autonomy, and it endorses traditions, often including traditional gender roles. For liberals, such a vision must be combated, not respected. If your moral matrix rests entirely on the Care and Fairness Foundations, then it's hard to hear the sacred overtones in America's unofficial motto, E Pluribus Unum, from many, one. By sacred, I mean the concept I introduced with the Sanctity Foundation in the last chapter. It's the ability to endow ideas, objects, and events with infinite value, particularly those ideas, objects, and events that bind a group together into a single entity. The process of converting pluribus, diverse people, into unum, a nation, is a miracle that occurs in every successful nation on earth. Nations decline or divide when they stop performing this miracle. In the 1960s, the Democrats became the party of pluribus. Democrats generally celebrate diversity, support immigration without assimilation, oppose making English the national language, don't like to wear flag pins, and refer to themselves as citizens of the world. Is it any wonder that they have done so poorly in presidential elections since 1968? The president is the high priest of what sociologist Robert Bella calls the American civil religion. The president must invoke the name of God, though not Jesus, glorify America's heroes in history, quote its sacred texts, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and perform the transubstantiation of pluribus into unum. Would Catholics ever choose a priest who refuses to speak Latin or who considers himself a devotee of all gods? In the remainder of the essay, I advise Democrats to stop dismissing conservatism as a pathology and start thinking about morality beyond care and fairness. I urged them to close the sacredness gap between the two parties by making greater use of the loyalty, authority, and sanctity foundations, not just in their messaging, but in how they think about public policy and the best interests of the nation. What I had missed. The essay provoked strong reactions from readers, which they sometimes shared with me by email. On the left, many readers stayed locked inside their care-based moral matrices and refused to believe that conservatism was an alternative moral vision. For example, one reader said that he agreed with my diagnosis, but thought that narcissism was an additional factor that I had not mentioned. Quote, "Lack of compassion fits them," the Republicans, "and narcissists are also lacking this important human trait," end quote. He thought it was sad that Republican narcissism would prevent them from understanding my perspective on their illness. Reactions from the right were generally more positive. Many readers with military or religious backgrounds found my portrayal of their morality accurate and useful, as in this email. Quote, "I recently retired from the U.S. Coast Guard after 22 years of service. After I retired, I took a job with a government science agency. The new office's culture tended more towards the liberal, independent model. What I am finding here is an organization rife with individualism and infighting at the expense of larger goals. In the military, I was always impressed with the great deeds that could be accomplished by a small number of dedicated people with limited resources. In my new group, I'm impressed when we can accomplish anything at all." End quote. I also received quite a few angry responses, particularly from economic conservatives who believed I had misunderstood their morality. One such reader sent me an email with the subject line, "Head up ass," which he explained in this way. Quote, "I vote Republican because I'm against other people, authority figures, taking my money that I work hard for and giving it to a non-producing, welfare-collecting, single-mother, crack-baby-producing future Democrat. Simple. You're an overeducated philosopher with soft hands who gets paid to ask stupid questions and come up with reasonable answers. Go drop some acid and read some Jung." End quote. Another angry reader posted to a blog discussion his own list of the top 15 reasons that people vote Democrat. His number one reason was low IQ, but the rest of his list revealed a lot about his moral matrix and its central value. It included the following. 1. Laziness. 2. You want something for nothing. 3. You need someone to blame for your problems. 4. You're afraid of personal responsibility or simply not willing to accept any. 5. You despise people who work hard for their money, live their own lives, and don't rely on the government for help cradle to grave. 6. You've had 5 kids from 3 different men, and you need the welfare check. These emails were overflowing with moral content, yet I had a hard time categorizing that content using moral foundations theory. Much of it was related to fairness, but this kind of fairness had nothing to do with equality. It was the fairness of the Protestant work ethic and the Hindu law of karma. People should reap what they sow. People who work hard should get to keep the fruits of their labor. People who are lazy and irresponsible should suffer the consequences. This email and other responses from economic conservatives made me realize that I and my colleagues at yourmorals.org had done a poor job of capturing conservative notions of fairness, which focused on proportionality, not equality. People should get what they deserve based on what they have done. We had assumed that equality and proportionality were both part of the Fairness Foundation, but the questions we used to measure this foundation were mostly about equality and equal rights. We therefore found that liberals cared more about fairness, and that's what had made those economic conservatives so angry at me. They believed that liberals don't give a damn about fairness as proportionality. Are proportionality and equality two different expressions of the same underlying cognitive module, as we had been assuming? Are they both related to reciprocal altruism, as Robert Trivers had described it? It's easy to explain why people care about proportionality and are so keen to catch cheaters. That follows directly from Trivers' analysis of how we gain by exchanging favors with reliable partners. But what about equality? Are liberal concerns about political and economic equality really related to reciprocal altruism? Is the passionate anger people feel toward bullies and oppressors the same as the anger they feel toward cheaters? I looked into what was known about the egalitarianism of hunter-gatherers and found a strong argument for splitting apart these two kinds of fairness. The desire for equality seems to be more closely related to the psychology of liberty and oppression than to the psychology of reciprocity and exchange. After talking about these issues with my colleagues at yourmorals.org, and after we ran some new studies on various kinds of fairness and liberty, we added a provisional sixth foundation, liberty/oppression. We also decided to revise our thinking about fairness to place more emphasis on proportionality. Let me explain. The Liberty-Oppression Foundation. In the last chapter, I suggested that humans are, like our primate ancestors, innately equipped to live in dominance hierarchies that can be quite brutal. But if that's true, then how come nomadic hunter-gatherers are always egalitarian? There's no hierarchy, at least among the adult males. There's no chief, and the norms of the group actively encourage sharing resources, particularly meat. The archaeological evidence supports this view, indicating that our ancestors lived for hundreds of thousands of years in egalitarian bands of mobile hunter-gatherers. Hierarchy only becomes widespread around the time that groups take up agriculture or domesticate animals and become more sedentary. These changes create much more private property and much larger group sizes. They also put an end to equality. The best land and a share of everything people produce typically get dominated by a chief, leader, or elite class who takes some of their wealth with them to the grave for easy interpretation by later archaeologists. So, were our minds structured in advance of experience for hierarchy or for equality? For hierarchy, according to anthropologist Christopher Bohm. Bohm studied tribal cultures early in his career, but had also studied chimpanzees with Jane Goodall. He recognized the extraordinary similarities in the ways that humans and chimpanzees display dominance and submission. In his book, Hierarchy in the Forest, Bohm concluded that human beings are innately hierarchical, but that at some point during the last million years, our ancestors underwent a political transition that allowed them to live as egalitarians by banding together to rein in, punish, or kill any would-be alpha males who tried to dominate the group. Alpha male chimps are not truly leaders of their groups. They perform some public services, such as mediating conflicts, but most of the time they're better described as bullies who take what they want. Yet even among chimpanzees, it sometimes happens that subordinates gang up to take down alphas, occasionally going as far as to kill them. Alpha male chimps must therefore know their limits and have enough political skill to cultivate a few allies and stave off rebellion. Imagine early hominid life as a tense balance of power between the alpha and an ally or two, and the larger set of males who are shut out of power. Then, arm everyone with spears. The balance of power is likely to shift when physical strength no longer decides the outcome of every fight. That's essentially what happened, Bohm suggests, as our ancestors developed better weapons for hunting and butchering beginning around 500,000 years ago, when the archaeological record begins to show a flowering of tool and weapon types. Once early humans had developed spears, anyone could kill a bullying alpha male. And if you add the ability to communicate with language, and note that every human society uses language to gossip about moral violations, then it becomes easy to see how early humans developed the ability to unite in order to shame, ostracize, or kill anyone whose behavior threatened or simply annoyed the rest of the group. Bohm's claim is that at some point during the last half million years, well after the advent of language, our ancestors created the first true moral communities. In these communities, people used gossip to identify behavior they didn't like, particularly the aggressive, dominating behaviors of would-be alpha males. On the rare occasions when gossip wasn't enough to bring them into line, they had the ability to use weapons to take them down. Bohm quotes a dramatic account of such a community in action among the Kung Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert. Quote, "A man named Twi had killed three other people when the community, in a rare move of unanimity, ambushed and fatally wounded him in full daylight. As he lay dying, all of the men fired at him with poisoned arrows until, in the words of one informant, he looked like a porcupine. Then after he was dead, all the women, as well as the men, approached his body and stabbed him with spears, symbolically sharing the responsibility for his death." End quote. It's not that human nature suddenly changed and became egalitarian. men still tried to dominate others when they could get away with it. Rather, people armed with weapons and gossip created what Bohm calls reverse dominance hierarchies, in which the rank and file band together to dominate and restrain would-be alpha males. It's uncannily similar to Marx's dream of the dictatorship of the proletariat. The result is a fragile state of political egalitarianism achieved by cooperation among creatures who are innately predisposed to hierarchical arrangements. It's a great example of how innate refers to the first draft of the mind. The final edition can look quite different, so it's a mistake to look at today's hunter-gatherers and say, "See, that's what human nature really looks like." For groups that made this political transition to egalitarianism, there was a quantum leap in the development of moral matrices. People now lived in much denser webs of norms, informal sanctions, and occasionally violent punishments. Those who could navigate this new world skillfully and maintain good reputations were rewarded by gaining the trust, cooperation, and political support of others. Those who could not respect group norms or who acted like bullies were removed from the gene pool by being shunned, expelled, or killed. Genes and cultural practices, such as the collective killing of deviants, co-evolved. The end result, says Bohm, was a process sometimes called self-domestication. Just as animal breeders can create tamer, gentler creatures by selectively breeding for those traits, our ancestors began to selectively breed themselves, unintentionally, for the ability to construct shared moral matrices and then live cooperatively within them. The Liberty Oppression Foundation, I propose, evolved in response to the adaptive challenge of living in small groups with individuals who would, if given the chance, dominate, bully, and constrain others. The original triggers therefore include signs of attempted domination. Anything that suggests the aggressive, controlling behavior of an alpha male or female can trigger this form of righteous anger, which is sometimes called reactance. That's the feeling you get when an authority tells you you can't do something and you feel yourself wanting to do it even more strongly. But people don't suffer oppression in private. The rise of a would-be dominator triggers a motivation to unite as equals with other oppressed individuals to resist, restrain, and in extreme cases, kill the oppressor. Individuals who fail to detect signs of domination and respond to them with righteous and group-unifying anger face the prospect of reduced access to food, mates, and all the other things that make individuals and their genes successful in the Darwinian sense. The Liberty Foundation obviously operates in tension with the Authority Foundation. We all recognize some kinds of authority as legitimate in some contexts, but we are also wary of those who claim to be leaders unless they have first earned our trust. We're vigilant for signs that they've crossed the line into self-aggrandizement and tyranny. The Liberty Foundation supports the moral matrix of revolutionaries and freedom fighters everywhere. The American Declaration of Independence is a long enumeration of, quote, repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of absolute tyranny over these states, end quote. The document begins with the claim that all men are created equal, and ends with a stirring pledge of unity, quote, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, end quote. The French revolutionaries, similarly, had to call for fraternité and égalité if they were going to entice commoners to join them in their regicidal quest for liberté. The flag of my state, Virginia, celebrates assassination, as shown in Figure 8.3. It's a bizarre flag unless you understand the Liberty Oppression Foundation. The flag shows virtue, embodied as a woman, standing on the chest of a dead king with the motto, Sic semper tyrannis, thus always to tyrants. That was the rallying cry said to have been shouted by Marcus Brutus as he and his co-conspirators murdered Julius Caesar for acting like an alpha male. John Wilkes Booth shouted it from center stage at Ford's Theater moments after shooting Abraham Lincoln, whom Southerners perceived to be a tyrant who prevented them from declaring independence. Murder often seems virtuous to revolutionaries. It just somehow feels like the right thing to do, and these feelings seem far removed from Trivers' reciprocal altruism and tit-for-tat. This is not fairness. This is Bohm's political transition and reverse dominance. If the original triggers of this foundation include bullies and tyrants, the current triggers include almost anything that is perceived as imposing illegitimate restraints on one's liberty, including government, from the perspective of the American right. In 1993, when Timothy McVeigh was arrested,